The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Before we begin, I would like to draw your attention to not one, but two Americano events that are coming up in the upcoming days. One is on Saturday, the 19th of October, at Church House in central London, and that is at the Battle of Ideas. I'm going to be doing a live Americano podcast with Kate Andrews of this parish and Richard Johnson, who is a lecturer at Queen Mary University. And we're going to be looking at the election, race and class in particular. After that, I've already flagged this on the Americano show, but I'm doing it again. We will be hosting Nigel Farage at the Emmanuel Centre in London, in Westminster, for an evening discussion on Thursday, the 24th of October. Tickets are beginning to run out, so if you haven't got your ticket, book it now. You can do that by going to spectator.co.uk/book-your-tickets. It is at the Emmanuel Centre, as I said, and there is a drinks reception before the event starting at 7:30, so be prompt. I am delighted to be joined today by Shruti Rajakapalan, who is an economist at the MacArthur Centre at George Mason University, and a fascinating author about many things, in particular the nature of Indian Americans, because Indian Americans, I don't know if you've noticed, have featured quite prominently in this election. We have Kamala Harris, who is of American Indian descent. We have Usha Vance, who is J.D. Vance's wife. We've also had Nikki Haley, who came second in the Republican primaries, and another Republican presidential candidate, Vivek Ramaswamy, who is also of American Indian descent. Now, Shruti, what's fascinating about this is that Indians make up about, or the Indian diaspora makes up about 1.5% of the American population. And yet they seem to be at the forefront of power in America. What explains this?
Hi, Freddie. Thank you for having me. And this is a question that even I was fascinated with when I saw sort of, you know, one Indian American after the other. It started with water cooler conversations at the office where people were asking me how to pronounce Vivek Ramaswamy's name, or if we're both the same type of Indian American, and so on. And that's what got me thinking about this. I think the key to answer the question of why we have so many prominent Indian Americans in this present moment, sort of on the political stage or spotlight, is linked very tightly to American immigration policy over the last 100 years. So for the first half of the century, you know, the immigration policy in the United States was very much driven along racial lines. So the inclusions and exclusions, especially those who were Asian origin, were categoric in who was allowed into the country and who was kept out. And this started liberalizing, you know, in the mid-60s in the United States. And really, the generation that we see today, you know, on the Republican and the Democrat platform, you mentioned Usha Vance, Vivek Ramaswamy, Nikki Haley, Kamala Harris, they are all children of Indian immigrants who came in the first wave after the immigration restrictions sort of loosened up. And immigration is a curious thing. I mean, America really is a land of immigrants. But in the case of Indian immigration, it was a little bit different than our usual view, which is, you know, America accepting, you know, the poor huddled masses from the rest of the world, right? Most poor Indians were not in a position to make a very long trip to the United States to then work, you know, in a on an agricultural farm or at the back of a kitchen. The Indians who had the educational capital, who knew English, were already part of an Indian elite. But they were living in India in socialist times where opportunities were few and far between. And they were no longer the political elite because post-independence, India had already opened up the system and had universal adult franchise, which meant that their power as elites, especially, you know, sort of intergenerational privilege they had acquired through the caste system, you know, all the names I mentioned are typically upper castes, they suddenly started losing that power. And the opportunities in the United States were really extraordinary for this generation of Indians. So if you look at the early Indian migrants, they're really the parents of all the politicians we mentioned. And they were really some of the most educated Indians and Indian Americans. So, you know, Nikki Haley's parents are highly educated, you know, professors. Usha Vance's parents, Usha Vance's grandparents, you know, were physics professors. Same with Vivek Ramaswamy. His wife, Kamala Harris's mother, of course, was a professor in the STEM disciplines. Her father is Jamaican American, who was the first a Black American to be tenured at Stanford in the economics department. So this group really comes from that very elite set of immigrants, and that's clearly reflected. So in short, there is no conspiracy theory, nor is it just a question of DEI candidates to have, you know, sort of all different colors of the spectrum included on the platforms. This is really a generation of American, you know, Indian Americans who have capitalized on a global meritocracy, a lot of intergenerational privilege, and of course, the American dream of being able to reach the top, you know, if you work really hard.
It's interesting you mentioned that intergenerational privilege, and you talk in your in a piece you've written about it, about the caste system. Because someone, an ignoramus like me coming at this, might imagine that a lot of these Indians are coming because perhaps they've been blocked from being part of the absolute elite by the caste system. But what you're saying is that these people are actually the creme de la creme of the Indian caste system.
So, you know, elite has a couple of different connotations. So during the colonial period and briefly in the post-colonial period, those who were sort of the highest privilege holders within the caste system also held very high public office, either as bureaucrats, you know, through the British Civil Service and the Indian Civil Service, or by standing for elections. But as India had opened up to universal adult franchise very early on, suddenly in the political arena, those who were intergenerationally elite were not quite as powerful. And over a period of time, there were also a number of affirmative action programs, whether it was jobs in government or, you know, in the most elite institutions in India, like the IITs that everyone's heard of. So this, it's still, I mean, they're still very much part of the Indian elite. They are still coming from castes like the Brahmin caste. They have 2-3 generations of, you know, very high levels of education in the family. Oftentimes, you know, at least one, if not both parents, tend to be professors or doctors or scholars of some sort. So they had that kind of privilege and sort of elite position in society, but it didn't necessarily translate into a lot of wealth or a lot of political capital. And so this group also found itself the easiest to mobilize and travel abroad and start utilizing, you know, the various institutions that can get someone who has a lot of educational capital, you know, another shot in a new country. So they've done extraordinarily well in the UK. They've done extraordinarily well in the US. And these universities were also looking for highly meritorious candidates. So the universities were also selecting. So, you know, there are really 3-4 levels of selection. So one layer of selection is sort of the birth accident, right? What was the caste and the family they were born into? A second layer of selection is, did they or their parents go to elite institutions like the IITs or Oxford and Cambridge in the United Kingdom, or, you know, the various institutes of technology and STEM programs in the United States? And then the third layer comes in the American job market. This is another kind of filtering, right? So once the universities filter you, and then the job market filters you too. So once you are triple filtered in this sense, it's really, they are really picking the creme de la creme. Not, again, not because it was all orchestrated or there's some global elite puppet master pulling the strings, but just the way the immigration system panned out in these countries and the push factor from India, which ended up exporting some of its most educated folks abroad.
And I think polling suggests on average that Indian Americans are more likely to be Democrat than Republican. But of the four figures we've mentioned, let's put Kamala Harris to one side for a moment. Three of them are Republican. And in Britain, too, we see with people like Rishi Sunak, Priti Patel, we see a lot of Asian Britons who are on the more conservative end of the political spectrum here. What do you think explains that?
So a couple of factors. There have been some, I mean, this is excellent, you know, survey work and research done by, you know, different folks in the US, like Devesh Kapoor, Milan Vaishnav, people at the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, D.C. And their surveys find and confirm exactly what you said, which is, you know, Indian Americans tend to lean Democrat if you ask them which party they are likely to vote for. However, there are a few characteristics about Indian Americans that explain this. One is they are a religious minority in the United States. And oftentimes, when you probe a little bit further in the survey about why they may not vote Republican or have more sympathy for the Democratic Party, it tends to be some concern about the most evangelical sort of right in the Republican Party. So that's, you know, one factor. The second factor is that they are largely still filtered through very elite American institutions, which now we have learned tend to be much more progressive and far less conservative in terms of representation. They are very much part of the coastal elite because they work in the IT sector or the finance sector or in STEM sciences and so on. But my theory is that I don't think this trend is going to hold too long. And the reason is some of the policies of the Democrat Party, which have been unfriendly to Indian Americans. So the first is on the question of highly skilled immigrants. On this, supposedly, there have been various points in time where there has been bipartisan support for increasing the cap on H-1B visa holders or, you know, having an easier pathway for them to get a green card and so on. But for various reasons, it's never really come to pass. And Indian Americans are the worst affected by some of these policies just because of their large numbers. And on the other hand, the Democrats are willing to, you know, take a chance on undocumented workers through executive orders and so on. But that is never extended to Indian Americans who largely came to the United States legally, who work in some of the most prestigious establishments, but are kind of stuck in this immigration pipeline. So the way I pose that is the Indian Americans are entirely for the Democrats to lose, not so much for the Republicans to win. That's one aspect. The second is, and maybe the entire DEI issue has peaked a little bit in the United States, but until the Supreme Court actually, you know, struck some of the policies, the admission policies of Harvard and the elite institutions down, there was quite clear discrimination against highly skilled Asian American students. And for this, for their parents, you know, which is really the Indian Americans that we're discussing, this brings back memories of why they might have left India in the first place, where there were a number of affirmative action quotas and so on, which meant they didn't get into their favored, you know, educational institution or their job. And that's what made them leave the country in the first place. And now coming to a new place, which technically promised a very equal platform, you know, America is supposed to be the most meritocratic or at least merit rewarding society in the world. And now suddenly their children facing quotas in these colleges because of this, you know, small progressive agenda is disconcerting to them. So because of some of these newer policies of the Democrats, I think they may lose Indian Americans unless they start paying attention and just stop treating them as another group that are, you know, persons of color and really start focusing on, hey, who are these people? What is it they really want? And how do they contribute to American society? And how can we ensure that they keep contributing to American society in the way that they expect.
Is there a fair amount of overlap in the point you just made with the tech sector? Because we've seen this year, you know, a lot of the leading figures in tech, or certainly, you know, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and there's a sort of general mood in Silicon Valley that the risk of being simplistic is anti-woke, and it's certainly keen to protect meritocracy from woke incursions. Given that so many Indian migrants to America do work in the tech sector, is there something going on there?
There might be, actually. You've picked up on something quite interesting. You know, personally, I find Silicon Valley to be a very mimetic culture, and it starts right at the top, right? I mean, you can see this every time the people right at the top start dressing in great crumpled t-shirts. Suddenly you'll see, you know, young students who are just joining, you know, all the big tech firms dress the same way as Mark Zuckerberg did or the way Steve Jobs used to. So there is a certain mimetic aspect to this. But I think this may be stronger in the case of Indian Americans because they tend to come from otherwise conservative families. And I mean, small c conservative, right? These are families that tend to be quite religious. They have very low rates of divorce. They save very hard and long for their children's college education, which in the United States can be quite expensive. And then to have the party that you trust and believe in come and say, we're going to have, you know, debt forgiveness for everyone, you know, as part of that woke ideology, doesn't sit that well with this group of people. So sure, they're persons of color, they're religious minority, they're an ethnic minority, but they also tend to be quite conservative in their choices. So I think this is the aspect that the Democrat Party needs to really grapple with when it comes to Indian Americans. And they're well poised to do it because, you know, they have people right at the top who are, you know, of Indian American origin.
Well, the person right at the top at the moment is Kamala Harris, of course. And I think it's fair to say she hasn't put her Indian identity at the absolute forefront of her campaign at the moment. She's very keen to also stress her African-American heritage. Do you think Indian-American voters will be attracted to her just on identity grounds, or does she need to appeal to them with a message that resonates?
I think, you know, just on identity grounds, it's not just that Kamala Harris won't appeal to them. I think any candidate doesn't appeal, you know, to most voters on identity grounds. It's, you know, all their everyday problems. It's healthcare. It is immigration. It is whether their children are going to age out of the H-1B visa dependency status. It is, you know, policies like debt forgiveness or Asian American quotas at universities. Inflation has been a really big talking point until recently, you know, in the United States. So I think all voters respond to very personal everyday problems. To the extent that there is Harris on top of the ticket, I think there might be a marginal effect that Indian Americans and their children can really make it and live the American dream. But I don't see any of her policies, I mean, which have been stated explicitly on her platform, as providing any special provision for Indian Americans that they would have, that, you know, based on that identity, they would vote in that direction. In fact, I think largely she's just been called out for it by, you know, candidates and pundits on the Republican Party side on, you know, how she sometimes leans Indian or leans Black or her accent changes and so on. But to me, that's just, she's a classic American candidate in the sense that she can code switch. She has mixed heritage like a lot of Americans. And she has a diverse background, which may appeal a little bit to everyone. But I don't think you can just rely on that.
One of the things she's attacked for most vociferously by Republicans is her past weakness on the issue of immigration. Whether or not she was border czar, let's not get into that. But certainly that seemed to be an area in which she's considered weak by the Republicans. Would Indian Americans in general agree with that criticism? Because they are, in many ways, the beneficiaries of the American immigration system in the way that it's tough because they've had to work through it. And so therefore, one might think they might be more concerned about large-scale illegal immigration and the sort of injustices they might perceive in the immigration system.
You got that absolutely right. You know, there is a sense that you know, for those who come from developing countries to the United States, including myself, there's always this sense that this is a country that truly believes in rule of law and equal protection, and everyone is given a fair chance. And, you know, for immigrants, if you just pay your dues, you know, you work really hard, you come in legally, you do all the right things, you move up in life, there is a prize at the end of it. And that's very much the definition of the American dream. And now that dream is eroding on two fronts, right? So one is there is an actual injustice that is taking place with Indian Americans because, you know, the U.S. imposes a 7% per country cap on employment-based green cards. And Indians are a disproportionately large group in the world. It's a 1.4 billion people. And they're also a disproportionately large group of immigrants in the United States because of the tech sector and the number of, you know, STEM and engineering students who come to the United States. And because of this, you know, country cap limit, all these workers and students who come to the United States, eventually they age out of their student visas and their work permits. And now I believe the backlog for the EB2 and EB3 categories, which are just, you know, sort of think of them as line two and line three or priority two and three for green cards, is effectively, you know, a lifetime. It's about 134 years, if I remember correctly. And most of them will die waiting for a green card, even though they did everything right, right? Right from their young age, they did well in classes, they did well at university, they got into excellent firms in the job market, but they will age out. And now comes the perceived injustice. I don't think undocumented workers getting asylum takes away from Indian Americans, you know, getting their legitimate position in American society through the immigration system, but it captures the news in a big way, and all the sympathy is directed in that direction. And the conversation in the United States is really about undocumented workers and how to make their entry and passage into the United States easier. And these two things juxtaposed next to each other make this a very big problem for Indian Americans. Most Indian Americans I know who've been waiting for decades for a green card are extremely unfavorable to illegal immigration and extremely against the platform that the Democrats have held on that issue, especially when they know that, you know, there could be an executive order, like a stroke of a pen, and Biden can change the fortunes of the others. How come this privilege is not extended to Indian Americans who've sort of earned their way in the United States, paid their taxes, made, you know, some of the most profitable companies in the United States and the world what they are because of their contribution to these funds. So you very much got that right. These two things next to each other almost make the problem worse.
The examples that we've talked about, quite a few of them are either the children of or themselves intermarried with white or earlier Native Americans. Is that something that is specific to Indian Americans, that they tend, even if they are from socially conservative families, they tend to intermarry more with the population, the native population?
I think largely Indian Americans tend to marry other Indian Americans, or, you know, they may be of different categories. That is, you know, American-born Indian Americans may marry someone who has just entered the United States through the university system or through the job market. But there's a lot of endogamy within Indian Americans. I think the reason for the intermarriage that you are seeing in more recent times, if you notice, all of them met at university, which is typically the way most people sort of, you know, meet their life partner, you know, high school, university, law school, medical school, and so on. And if you look at, say, you know, JD and Usha Vance or Vivek Ramaswamy and his wife Apurva, they all met at university, which doesn't seem that odd. And to that extent, even though you might think of it as marrying across ethnic lines or caste lines, they're really marrying the elite of the United States, right? And they are themselves the elite of the United States in an educational sense. So that doesn't surprise me quite as much.
And indeed, Mr. and Mrs. Sunak here from the United Kingdom, who have their own American links,
yes,
and very much higher education American links. So what we're dealing with here is a sort of very, very highly educated, very mobile, very elite, very intelligent set of people.
Absolutely. And I think it is important to understand them because we're going to see more of that trend. I think Kamala Harris, Rishi Sunak, they're the start of the trend. They're really the children of the first of the immigrants who managed to give their children a life that could enable them entry into some of the most globally elite establishments, not just within their country. And before this turns into one more conspiracy theory in the future, I think it's important for people in the UK, people in the United States, to really understand where these people are coming from and how they work their way up to the top.
And for a lot of these, they tend to be Hindu rather than Muslim. How important is Hinduism for these families, and how does it differ? How does Hinduism or the integration of Hinduism differ? I realise it's a difficult question, but how does it differ to, let's say, Islamic integration in Western societies?
Most of them come from, you're absolutely right, they come from Hindu families, and this may be just because, you know, they're coming from the home country where 83-84% of the population is Hindu. So though the immigrant population is also going to reflect some share of that. And overall, compared to Muslims, Hindus have better learning outcomes, educational outcomes, nutritional outcomes because of, you know, higher levels of socioeconomic progress. And these people are really from the absolute, you know, sort of top end of the elite system. So they will definitely outperform other religious minorities in the home country, which is India. So that is not so surprising. I think the promise of religious freedom in the United States is incredibly important. So if we look at the Hindus in the United States, very few or almost negligible number of them feel the need to convert or are forced to convert. They very much hold on to their religious traditions. You will see second, third generation Indian Americans continuing some of their family's traditions, like they remain vegetarian, for instance, or they, you know, speak their native language from whichever, you know, part of India they're from. They visit India pretty often to see their cousins. They're very much part of, you know, the religious traditions. I have attended a number of Indian American weddings, you know, having been in the US the last couple of decades, and they are remarkably similar to like a posh Delhi wedding that I might attend back home. So in that sense, the traditional nature of Hinduism is very much intact. Are they as devout as their parents and their grandparents? That's really hard to say. I think that's an incredibly individual thing. And I think it also depends on who they married. So for instance, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy has married another Hindu Indian, whereas, you know, Kamala Harris's mother, Shyamala, did not. So I think that has some effect on, you know, how religiously plural that particular family is. And Kamala Harris is now married to someone who's Jewish American, which I'm sure also has its own impact. So America being a religiously plural society, really guaranteeing religious freedom to all, I think, is the most important thing for the Hindu Indian Americans. The Muslims, I think, face similar constraints as Muslims from any other part of the world. Though I must say Muslims from India are considered extremely plural and moderate, at least in terms of perception. Now, it's hard to say until we start speaking about the individual. But most people in the UK and the United States that I speak with consider Indian Muslims to be some of the most secular, moderate people that they've met among the Muslim community and also among Indian Americans. But they're definitely a religious minority, and I imagine they make choices very similar to Hindu Indian American immigrants.
Shruti, it's an absolutely fascinating subject, and thank you so much for coming on to Americano to share your insights. I do hope we'll get you on again, perhaps after America has its first Indian-American president elected.
Thanks so much, Freddie. It was a pleasure to be here. I am not the betting sort, so I'll just wait to hear the news a few weeks from now, and hopefully we get to chat after that.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode of The Americano Show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows. Thanks again for listening. All the best.